Takeo Spikes joins us on Sports Byline, the former Pro Bowl linebacker who played 15 years in the NFL with Cincinnati, who drafted him in the first round, and with Buffalo, the Eagles, 49ers, and Chargers. And he was an All-American at Auburn and is one of only seven linebackers to achieve more than 200 career starts with the NFL. And he was a leader both statistically and in presence on every team at every level he played for. And his nickname, TKO, stood for the Knockout. He was named after Japan's 66th prime minister. And besides football, Takeo has other talents, including photography. And he has a wonderful book out called Behind the Mask. It combines his personal narrative as well as iconic images and his personal photography, focusing on the NFL's great linebackers. Takeo, before we start and talk about your career and the book, take me back to Sandersville, Georgia, where you grew up.
Going all the way back to Sandersville, very small town, rural, little town, city. It wasn't much to do as far as entertainment for kids when you look at city life for kids and the opportunities for them to be involved. But my upbringing was very structured. I was fortunate enough to grow up in a two-parent home. And I think a lot of the qualities that I've developed to this day is not so much, well, it's a testament of what was taught to me, but a lot of it was just from what I saw from my mother and father every day on a consistent level. And that's the type of town that it was, definitely a blue collar. And at the same time, when I look back and I go all the way back and think about everything that I went through, and, you know, you try to compare country boys to city boys, the thing that I really appreciate about growing up in Sandersville is that it really taught me an alternative way to get things done and really taught me the true essence of hard work, dedication, making a commitment. Because, you know, when you grow up in small towns like that, the only thing that you know is that. And then when you see TV and you hear people talking about traveling, it piques your interest. And so for me, I understood in order to change my circumstances, not only did I have to leave and go to school, college, but it was important for me, since I drew to the game of football, that I wanted to take it to another level, to where it would have gave me an opportunity to go out and see all of the things that you see in books, all of the things that you see on TV.
You've always been passionate. You always had a fire in your belly. Where did that come from?
I will give a lot of credit to my mother, and she is a little fireball, Miss Lily Spikes. She is, you know, I remember her saying when I was 7 years old, when I first started playing football in between 6 and 7, she didn't know anything about football, and she still doesn't now. Can you believe it after all of this time? But I remember her saying, if you want something bad enough, nothing will be able to stop you, and you will be able to create a focus that's unbreakable. And I remember those words when I was 7 years old. I didn't really understand. I didn't understand it at the time, but, you know, that's where I got my focus from her, because her past circumstances and what she wanted her family to stand for.
I know that when your dad passed away in the early part of your NFL career, it was a very interesting quote from you. He said, "My father was a good man, really showed me the work ethic, taught me to feel like you're not entitled to anything. And if I can live my life just as he did, even three quarters of the way he did, then I figure I'll have a pretty successful life." He meant a lot to you. And is there anything in a nuance that he passed on to you that you still, you know, practice today?
Yeah, I have a 14-year-old daughter, and it's important for me, even though I'm retired from the game of football, I want her to know that I'm still active as far as finding other ways to earn money other than going out beating up my body. So for me, when I look at my father, the reason why I drew so close to him and I understood is because, you know, my father, you know, he grew up in the civil rights era, and also he grew up on a plantation. And so for him and his family, he didn't have the opportunity to go to school, because by him staying on the plantation and staying in someone else's home, they just didn't have time. So he was forced to quit school and go work in the fields. And so from his hard work ethic and what he went through as far as evolution and time after the civil rights era, he made it a point for each one of his kids to not take anything for granted, to understand nobody owes you anything. Everything that you get, you have to go out and work very hard for it. And I really saw that come to life. I remember one day on Christmas, I was expecting to get a go-kart. And I talked about that go-kart for 2 weeks before Christmas. When Christmas came, not only was my father, he wasn't at home because he was working, which I didn't know. But when he finally made it home, I'm thinking, okay, I know my dad. He's going to have the go-kart on the back of the truck. So I'm looking out of the window. He get out of the truck, and I'm like, why isn't he going to the back of the truck? He walks into the house, and he said, Merry Christmas, son. And I was like, Daddy, where's my go-kart? He paused and looked at me, and he said, you know the reason why I wasn't here at midnight when Christmas first came in? And I said, no, why? He said, because I have much more important things to worry about to be able to not only provide for you, but provide for the rest of your brothers and your sister before I go out and waste money on a go-kart. You see, it means that much to me that you have a roof over your head and you have the opportunity to have a chance to win at life by me working on Christmas so you don't have to go out and work, so you don't have to stop school the way that I did in middle school.
He certainly did give you a wonderful perspective on life. And let me ask you about your early football days. You know, you played at Washington County High School, and you earned All-American honors. You were named Georgia's Mr. Football and Georgia Player of the Year. What did football fulfill in your life in your early years?
It just gave me a sense of accomplishment. It gave me a sense of belonging. And from that aspect, I grew up and a lot of kids loved to play basketball, and that was the easiest thing to play because it was the cheapest thing to play, just like football. Only thing you needed was a basketball and find a goal. And so when I first started playing at a young age, you know, it's 5-on-5, but I was always that guy who they would say, okay, you got to get next. I was the smallest guy out of the crew. And so by me being able to play football, that allowed more opportunity because of numbers. And I remember just making a big catch. We played in the middle of the road like crazy idiots. And I made a big catch, got tackled out of bounds. And I remember walking back and guys were like, dang, Spikes, you really can play, huh? And I was like, yeah, you daggone right I can play. You know, and so from that moment, that really – my sense of belonging was, I knew I could play this game. Then it turned into, let me show them how good I am just because you slept on me on the basketball court.
We have about 90 seconds before we have to break here. And I want to ask you, you were at Auburn. You were an All-American player there. Same intensity, same success at Auburn. But I want to ask you about one particular game. It came in the 1997 campaign. Outstanding season for Auburn. You found yourselves in the SEC championship, and that was against Tennessee and Peyton Manning. You lose that game 30-29, but what struck you the most about Peyton Manning, a future Hall of Famer?
You know what struck me the most about Peyton Manning, and it brought back bad memories? 2 years ago, we all had the opportunity to see Peyton Manning in the playoffs when everybody wrote him off, and he came back. And he played, he didn't necessarily burn it up, but Peyton made the plays that he needed to make for his team to help them win. And that's what I remember most about playing against him in that 1998 championship game, SEC, is he wouldn't go away. I mean, we beat him down good, but he just would not go away. And that, and for me, when people talk about Peyton Manning, that's one thing I think he really doesn't get enough of, because most of the time people see him coming out, striking early. Okay, he's on fire. But the thing is, he's very resilient, similar to Tom Brady. You know, both of those guys, they don't fight, and you have to put your foot on their throat in order to make them quit.
Takeo Spikes is with us. We're going to be talking about his NFL career when we come back. Former Pro Bowl linebacker who played 15 years in the NFL with Cincinnati, who drafted him in the first round, also with Buffalo, the Eagles, the 49ers, and the Chargers. And a little later on, we'll be talking about his book. As we continue across the country and around the world, we've got you on America's sports talk show, Sports Byline. We're talking football this hour with Takeo Spikes, the former Pro Bowl linebacker. He was drafted when he came out of Auburn as an All-American, spent 15 years in the National Football League, drafted by Cincinnati in the first round. Did you expect them to draft you, and what did you expect the NFL experience to be like? How was it similar to or different from what you thought about, Takeo?
I didn't expect them to draft me. And two-part question, but who I did, at first I knew I had the opportunity to go as high as, I want to say, number six to Chicago, but they took Curtis Enos. And I knew after that it could fall anywhere from maybe 9 to 12. The team who had the 12th pick was the Atlanta Falcons. So once we got the 10, Fred Taylor got off of the board, went to Jacksonville. That's when I was like, okay, the phone rung. It was the Atlanta Falcons, and they said, hey, you know, if you're still there, we're going to pull the trigger. And number 11 pick happened, and I was like, oh, man, I'm going home to Atlanta. And I still remember this. When the commissioner got up and called my name, I'm going to say not my name, but the number 12 pick, he said, with the number 12 pick, the Atlanta Falcons select the Atlanta Falcons select linebacker. And I'm like, yeah, Keith Brooking out of Georgia Tech. And I was like, no. And I don't remember hearing anything after that. I put my head down maybe for about 30 seconds. And I looked up at my agent at the time and I said, Sims, who has the next pick? Because I didn't even think that I would go past the Atlanta Falcons. I just, you know, just my thought process. And he looked at me, and he said, Cincinnati. And I was like, as soon as he said Cincinnati, the phone rung. It was Dick LeBeau. And Dick LeBeau said, hey, young fella, I hope you're ready to be a Bengal, because we would love to have you. And I said, Coach, I'm here. I'm your guy. You took a chance, and I promise you, you won't forget it. And so ever since then, that was my – great experience of understanding or not understanding how it went. And then just from the NFL side, what I expected, for me, I was terrified of coming into the league, being a top 15 pick, because you hear so many horror stories about guys who just don't pan out. And for me, I wanted to come in and not only just prove to the world, but I wanted to prove to every guy on that team, especially my veterans, that I'm worth my salt. That was important for me, because I knew at the end of the day, if I can get their respect, then everything else will fall in alignment as far as being recognized as, okay, he's legit as a top 15 pick. Then I knew I could take it to another level. Okay, this guy really can play. And then I wanted to keep advancing, where my thought process was turning it into an all-pro.
You certainly did do that, and, I mean, you burst onto the scene, not in just a normal way. You burst on big time. You started all the preseason games, all the regular season games in your rookie year, and you led the team in tackles. When does an athlete, particularly one in a strategic position like linebacker that sees so much action, to KO, when do they know they have the respect not only of their own teammates but the opposition that they play?
I had a defining moment, and when I was in Cincinnati, we didn't win a lot of games, but we had great battles. I remember playing against Pittsburgh, and it was one of those games to where I knew, okay, if we lost, I'm going to make sure that one guy is going to give me some type of credit, because I am trying to crush his skull. I mean, that was my intention when I walked on the football field, because that's how I wanted to be perceived. It didn't happen until my fourth year. And consistently I was playing, We played against Baltimore, beat Baltimore. It was right after they won the Super Bowl. But then we played against Pittsburgh, and I remember coming home that offseason, and Hines Ward, he's one of my friends, and every time we got together, they would laugh and talk about, oh, Spikes, y'all knew y'all wasn't going to win. Y'all are horrible. You're bad. But at the end of his sentence, he said, you know what, though? I can say all of that, but the one thing I truly can say, he said, Spikes, you balled. And our offense, we had to make sure we put a hat on you if we were going to be successful. That was just a common statement for him. For me, it gave me validation that, okay, what I'm doing is the right preparation. I'm doing something right because now I know opposing teams, especially the Pittsburgh Steelers, they're saying, we got to cover him up. We got to make sure we block him in order to have a chance to run the ball. I knew then at that time that I was becoming into a pretty darn good player.
After not finishing better than 6-10 during any of your five seasons in Cincinnati, you stated that you'd rather sign with a playoff contender and sign as a free agent with Buffalo, but again with them, no playoffs. And after 4 years with the Bills, you were traded to Philadelphia. And the Eagles made the playoffs six of the previous 7 years before you got there, before you were traded to them. However, by not making the playoffs in your one season there, you had gone eight seasons without being part of a playoff team. How frustrating was it for you?
Very hard. It was very tough because, I mean, you got to remember going all the way back where I came from, Washington County, Sandersville, we won. I remember my last 3 years there, 41-3, state championship, even got to Auburn. Came one game from playing in the SEC championship, left as a junior, played in the SEC championship, got recognized by all major media outlets, MVP of the Peach Bowl. And, like, I had success at every level, team success, but it hurt me to my heart to give everything I had for 8 years and, well, actually 9 years, and not even have a playoff berth, because that's when I started to realize that, yeah, you can be great as an individual, but if you're not winning or if your team is not winning games, people are not going to look at you as, okay, he is one of the main guys. That's the reason why I felt like it took me so long to make it to the Pro Bowl, because I never played on a winning team, and it was so gratifying when I finally made it when I went to Buffalo. A lot of that was due to the fact that we had the number two defense in the league that year, all the years that I was there, number two or number three.
In 2008, you signed with the 49ers, but this is the stat. I want everybody to understand how good DeKeo was and how consistent he was, that he only missed four tackles over his three seasons with the 49ers. I don't know how anybody does that. Explain it.
Determined. I had the eye of the tiger, and somebody said, that can't be right. I said, go back and watch the film. Trust me. I said, I thought about talking about it, but I'm glad somebody saw the time to keep up with that stat, and they actually saw it. And for me, it was what really motivated me, Ron, to really get to that level. I was just so mad, so angry. I was furious every day, including days for practice, that I went through everything throughout my entire career, and I didn't have anything to show for it. And it made me realize the importance of teamwork. It made me realize how important it is to have a great GM. It made me realize how important it is to have scouts to bring not only great players in. I just think anybody can find a great player, but it really the true talent is finding players who can come in and play role players and finding role players who can actually play above their level. To me, that's the greatest gift of all time. And it just put everything in perspective for me. So when I took that feeling in San Francisco, it was personal. I wanted people to know that not only am I a baller, but I still could play going into year 10, because that was very, very important for me, especially after coming off of tearing my Achilles. in Buffalo at the height of my prime. And so at that time, nobody never came back from tearing their Achilles. The only person who came back and played consistently was Dan Marino. But I didn't count Dan Marino because he's a quarterback. He's not doing all of the moving that I did. And so, you know, for me, that's what really motivated me. I wanted people to know that not only am I still around, but I'm still the guy who you still have the game plan for.
We got about 35 seconds before we have to break, but you got to explain to me, you became famous for your sack dance. How did you develop that?
Well, it happened my first year playing in Cincinnati. Eric Ripp, the Baltimore Ravens, he just tried to cut me on a blitz. I jumped over him, sacked the quarterback, and I used to love to watch karate movies. Bruce Lee, Martin with Dragonfly Jones, and it just spontaneously, it just came out. And from that point, all the guys loved it in the locker room, and they was like, do it again, do it again. And so it just kind of, it fitted the mold, even with my name being Japanese. So it just kind of like was a natural, it was a natural take for me.
Takeo Spikes with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about his wonderful book, a book that I'm going to recommend to you. And also, we're going to talk about in San Francisco, the dynamic duo, a very special relationship he had with another linebacker for the San Francisco 49ers. We've got you on America's Sports Talk Show. Takeo Spikes has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. We're talking about his career, and toward the tail end, he was with the San Francisco 49ers, finished up with the San Diego Chargers. But, well, you were with San Francisco. There was a young Patrick Willis, and you two became close. Tell me what you saw in him in the early going of meeting him and playing with him.
Ron, I saw a lot of greatness in Patrick Willis. Actually, when I looked at him, I saw a younger version of Takeo Spikes. And I realized I didn't want him to have the same start to his career as I had for mine, meaning not winning a lot of games because, I mean, everybody knows San Francisco was an organization that was struggling. And he came in as a rookie, and you could see that he had flashes of brilliance on a consistent level. And the only thing, when I got there in training camp, I saw, you know, certain guys, they didn't want to, for lack of a better word, really bow down or just say, you know what, even though he's young, he really is the guy. And so for me, being in my 10th year, I was like, man, this guy can play. And I made it personal. I understood at that time, I didn't know how much longer I was going to be playing, but I made a promise to myself. It wasn't even about me. I knew I would be okay. I wanted to give something to him that nobody never gave to me in my earlier years. And so I consistently talked to Patrick. I consistently made sure that we spent time with each other to let him know that, listen, my time is my time. Like, I'm okay. I'll forever be okay. But I want to make sure you accomplish everything you want to at a young age, because that's when you become legendary. That's what I felt. And so I was that guy. If he wanted to say something to somebody, being just a second-year player, but he did not feel comfortable talking to somebody, I was that guy to enforce it. So it was, I kind of took on the big brother role. Like, if I saw him thinking it, I was the person who said it.
Mentoring is such an important part in life in general, but also in sports as well. And you once said of Patrick, with Patrick, I've always admired how great he wants to be at a young age. That's how he gained my respect. He would always just hound me and ask me questions. He was the sponge and I was the bucket of water. That's why our relationship is bigger than just on the field. He's like a brother to me. Were you surprised to see him walk away from the game when he did?
I was surprised. And the crazy thing is he really gave me heads up that he was going to do it maybe 2 weeks before he did it. I just didn't believe that he would walk away from the game because I knew how much he loved it. But after I sat back and I thought about it, and I actually went to go interview him when I was working with the NBC Sports Pro Football Talk. And, you know, he said, Takeo, you know me better than anybody. I never played this game because I never was motivated because of money. I've always played this game because I knew I was good at it and I wanted to be great. And another thing that really tipped me off was that he always had foot problems. And that was the main thing that he struggled with, not just on game day. He struggled with that on practice days. And so the more I sat back and just kind of really, you know, took that in, I understood the reason why, because he really put a value, a high value or a high premium on his health, understanding that, you know, a lot of guys don't play 10 years. A lot of guys don't even play 15 years. But even if we look at 15 and say that's a long time, when you're done playing, you're going to live a lot longer life, longer than 15 years. And so he understood the value of that, and I respected that.
Yeah, one of the things I respected about him is that he understood himself so well, and it showed something about his character, that he had the right perspective on what was important to him, and you just confirmed that. Let's talk about the book. It's called Behind the Mask. It combines your personal narrative along with iconic images, both in color and black and white, and in photographs, and also focusing on the NFL's great linebackers. Tell me a little bit how you got interested and love for photography, because I know your mom was involved in it with you as well. Tell me that story.
Well, it first started off, my mother, she always took pictures when we were younger, and great moments that she captured, but they were blurry. The images, they were not in focus. And so from that time, I was like, Mom, let me show you the camera. Let me have the camera. I'm going to show you how to take a picture. And then it was like, this is how you do it. Okay, this is how you do it. And the more and more I kept doing it, then it just kept evolving. I still didn't have a clue that I really loved photography like that. But everywhere I went, I always had a camera. The true defining time for me is we played in an international series game in London. I was playing with the 49ers, and we played against the Broncos. I remember playing against Carolina the week before we went to London. I got on the plane with my camera because I was ready to go to London to take all of these shots. And the guys on the plane looked at me and say, Spikes, you are too damn big to be having a camera. And so I was like, what? And they was like, nah, you too big to be having a camera. What are you doing taking it, you know, with the camera? And so for me, it was like, all right, you just challenged me. And so I made it a point to walk around the entire city with my mother, and we took a lot of shots of all of the monuments, changing of the guards. And when I got back on the plane, headed after the game, going back to San Francisco, all of the guys came over to me and said, let me see a couple of the shots. And I showed them the shots. Then one guy turned into five turned into 10. Before I knew it, I had the entire plane asking, hey, man, can I have a couple of those shots? And those were the same guys who said, I'm too big to be having a camera. And so that really gave me validation, like, you're on to something else, and I think you really could be good at it if you take it seriously.
And you profile the linebackers because, as you say, they are football's fiercest gridiron warriors. And for those, if you pick up this book, there are beautiful portraits of London Fletcher, Harry Carson, Ted Hendricks, Bobby Bell, Ricky Jackson, Willie Lanier, also Kevin Green, Mike Singletary, Derek Brooks, Cornelius Bennett, and others in that. But I was interested in something that I saw on your website about the book, the commonality of great linebackers. You said they had a defining moment. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, because me, when I set out to do this project Behind the Mask, it's more than a stat line. It's for me, I was trying to get into the deep, most inner thought on why did they make that decision on, I want to be great. I want to play this game to be the top. And that defining moment that they all had in common is they all wanted to change their circumstances. And some guys grew up poor in poverty. Some guys didn't like the fact that they couldn't travel, so they was inspired by picking up a magazine that was left in their mother's and father's house, and they realized that the world was way bigger than the block they grew up on. And so everybody had something different, but that moment all came down to the same thing. I want to change my circumstances where I'm at this given time. And the thing they all had in common is that they made a sacrifice. They made a commitment to something that was way bigger than them, and they did not sway from it. And I think what I know from them making that commitment, one part of success led to two, and then two led to four. And each guy really grabbed on to that, and they held on to that, whether or not if it was faith, whether or not if it was from poverty, whether or not if both of their parents was on drugs. And they knew that if I know I can make it, I can pull my family out of the hood, get them into a better environment to where they don't have to be on this bad substance anymore.
You also said something that also caught my eye and ear, and that is everyone has two kind of wolves in them, the good wolf and the bad wolf. What differentiates the good one from the bad one?
Well, especially men, you have to be careful, just anybody, you have to be careful about what, not only what you hear, but you have to be careful about what you see on a consistent basis. Because if you're not careful, if you are that type of person who likes to hear about drama, then subconsciously, that's the only thing that you're going to think about. If you are a pessimistic type person, then you will look for stuff on TV. You will find the reality TV shows. You know, I knock it, but I don't knock it. But a lot of it is filled with a lot of drama. And so you are what you repeatedly do. Charles Barkley told me that at a young age. And so the more that you feed your body, your mind, negative things, then you can expect negative thoughts. If you feed your body, your mind positive things, then you can have an optimistic mindset that will allow you to have success in whatever field or trade that you decide to go into.
The name of the book is called Behind the Mask by Takeo Spikes. I'm going to urge you to check this book out, and we're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline USA Book Corner. You know the statistics as well as I do about how long somebody plays professional sports. We've all seen the horror stories of what happens. They either die early or they have money problems and everything. That's not the case with you, and I can only think of a handful of others that have made that transition to a post-career. Tell me when you started thinking about it and how you made that transition mentally and emotionally.
I just realized that I love options. It was two things. One, I love options. And I never wanted to be pigeonholed. That's the reason why I went back to school after I retired, because I just felt like people were trying to put me in a box. And, you know, when you try to go get some of these jobs, whether or not if it's you want to be on NBC, you want to be on CBS, you know, the nature of the beast is the executives are going to hire guys who are highly decorated. And I mean, meaning from Super Bowls, whether or not if it's Pro Bowls, but mostly Super Bowls, they want a champion. And I felt like my story is just as good as anybody else because of everything that I went through and the success I was still able to achieve after all of those years when people, when we just never won. And so for me, basically that's what really drove me, is to have options, to give myself more options. That's the reason why I got my degree, went back and got my MBA from the University of Miami. And then the other thing is from my mother. I wake up in the morning looking for a challenge. And if somebody lightweight challenges me, not necessarily in a physical way, but just from a mental way, I like to think of it as intellectual properties. I'm going to do whatever it takes. If it takes me staying up half of the night trying to find the answer, I'm going to do it. And that, you know, for me, that's how I want to make sure that I ensure that I'm not a guy who was being a statistic. Oh, I can't even say it, statistic. You know, that's very important for me, Ron, because I have a daughter. She's 14 years old. And, I mean, she'll tell you right now, I know she probably gets tired of hearing my mouth, but what's more important for me is I not only do I talk to her, but I want to live the life and show her, like, this is what, when you want to be successful, this is what you got to do. It's a consistent grind, and that's important to me.
that is important because you're setting an example for her to follow and to see. As we close this out, we got about a minute left. When you look back across your career, is there one particular moment that's kind of engraved into KO Spikes' mind that kind of brings a smile to his face?
Yeah, I think it's two moments. One, I thought it was real neat, and it involves the fans of Buffalo. My last year in Cincinnati, last game of the year, we played Buffalo, and they knew I was going to be a free agent. And when I walked out of the tunnel in the city of Buffalo, half of the stadium was yelling my name, and they had Buffalo jerseys on with my last name on the back. Then the other thing that I'm most proud of, what I really think what defines Taquio Spikes, is when I tore my Achilles my seventh year in the league, people wrote that I would never play again because they have never seen anybody come back and play other than Dan Marino. And for me to come back and not only play, but to play at a high level for 8 years after that, that was unheard of. And I put in so much time. I put in so much work. And for me, that is what really defines the type of not only player, but just the person I am, my mentality.
Taquio Spikes with his former Pro Bowl linebacker who played 15 years in the NFL. Boy, he was a good one. We continue on Sports Byline.